We start, as always, with our look at what's in the papers this morning. And our panel in studio this morning, Sheila Riley, Head of Digital at Iconic News and former editor of the Longford Leader. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning, Gavin.
Hugh O'Connell is a political correspondent at Independent Newspapers. Good morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Gavin.
And a first-time contributor to the panel, Jim McGrath, who's a public affairs director with Teneo Ireland and a former government advisor. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Gavin.
And thank you very much for coming in, and I hope I've pronounced Teneo properly, because I've been honestly dwelling over that one for hours this morning.
You have indeed. Thank you.
Good. Excellent stuff. Good start. Right. Thanks for all for coming in this morning. Let's have a quick look at what's in the front pages of today's papers. We'll start with the Sunday Times, because there's loads there. The main story concerns, it's another story by Mark Tye about payments at the FAI. The FAI has paid a friend of John Giles up to €300,000 over the space of 5 years for coming up with the concept of the John Giles Foundation, its fundraising walks and a kit purchasing idea. If you want to listen back to News Talk Breakfast this morning, we did replay some audio of John Giles talking to Nathan Murphy on Off the Ball previously about that, so you can listen back to that on newstalk.com. Elsewhere on the front page of the Sunday Times, English and Scottish police readied to patrol Irish border. Ministers have drawn up detailed plans to deploy police officers from English forces to Northern Ireland in the event of a no deal, which obviously carries some echoes of things that happened in the past. In high-risk or emergency situations, police can be sent to other parts of the UK in a procedure known as mutual aid, previously used during the London riots and the G8 summit in Fermanagh. Under contingency plans, around 300 Scottish police will be deployed to support the PSNI as a preliminary step. However, if civil unrest or sectarian violence spirals, officers from forces including London's Metropolitan Police could be called on. And that, of course, follows on from the Sunday Times reporting about Operation Yellowhammer last week. Also on the front page, this is a story that we will be coming back to. Plan to kick private care out of public hospitals to cost €6.6 billion, which Stephen O'Brien tells us is twice as long, costs €6.6 billion, and will take twice as long as recommended in this longer care strategy adopted by the government, according to a new report sent to Simon Harris. It would take about 10 years to remove all public private hospital treatment from public settings, which is twice as long as the committee that devised this longer care report suggested it would a couple of years ago. There is much more, by the way, inside the Sunday Times about the FAI, including some board minutes where John Delaney tells the FAI board that he was keeping a defamation complaint against the news website running, even though his case was weak, to prevent the website from writing negative stories about the association, which gives you some insight into how things were run in the FAI in the last couple of years. Let's move on to some other papers. The Sunday Independent: overrun GPs turn away new patients. Wayne O'Connor has this story. Almost half of the country's GP practices are operating at maximum capacity and cannot take on new patients, a Sunday Independent investigation has found. Inquiries by this newspaper to doctor surgeries across the country show 44% of those surveyed are unable to see new patients. A small number, 42%, said their doors are open for new patients to join their practice. The remaining practices did not know if they could take on a new patient, or said that they'd have to consider an application before making a decision on registering a person seeking medical care. I think a lot of people would have known that there was some shortages in GPs, but perhaps not quite that acute, or that they were spread so evenly across the country. Also on the front page, Johnson toned down Brexit stance after bomb. Government officials, that's Irish government officials, believe a dissident Republican attack on the border last week forced Boris Johnson to tone down his language about Ireland and the controversial backstop. A senior government source close to Simon Coveney claimed that the terrorist attack in Fermanagh resulted in the British Prime Minister rethinking his strategy of targeting the backstop. The source made the extraordinary suggestion that Mr. Johnson and, quote, the Brits became, quote, a bit friendlier towards Ireland as a direct result of the dissident attack, which was aimed at killing PSNI officers. The suggestion that dissident activity could influence British government policy on Brexit is sure to cause alarm within political and security circles, it says. Moving on to the Sunday Business Post, co-living developer says residents are not covered by tenancy legislation. This is a story by Killian Woods. People who've been paying attention to co-living will know that the Department of Housing admitted some months ago that there was some question marks around exactly what tenancy protections would apply to people living in co-living arrangements. Killian Woods has discovered this morning that apparently there might not be any at all. The government is coming under pressure to close an apparent legal loophole after a co-living developer contested that residents in its controversial new developments have no protection under tenancy laws. Barter Capital, which is the firm behind a 208 bed space co-living scheme approved in Dunleary, has sent a legal memo to Dublin City Council and An Bord Pleanála claiming that its shared living developments cannot be regulated under tenancy and housing laws. The company has secured legal advice which argues that the protections of the Residential Tenancies Act do not apply to shared living residents. That would mean the co-living tenants would not be protected against rent hikes above limits set by the state. I suspect it would also mean that they wouldn't have any protection against minimum eviction periods as well. Also on the front page, again, another Brexit story. Government rejects new Tory blueprint to avoid hard border. A new report touted by Boris Johnson as key to solving the backstop standoff has been dismissed by the Irish government. Perhaps no surprise there. That is the report around alternative arrangements at the Irish border, which suggested that the hard border could be avoided by harnessing existing technologies, which should be up and running within 3 years, apparently poo-pooed by the Irish government. Moving on to some of the tabloids. Irish Mail on Sunday. Maria Bailey kept her job after sacking, which is quite the unusual headline. Swingate TD Maria Bailey's removal from the Housing Committee chair was declared a shambles last night after a series of key blunders were confirmed by the Oireachtas. The long and the short of it is that Leo Varadkar declared on July 23rd that Maria Bailey would now no longer be chairing the Oireachtas Committee on Housing and Planning. But it turns out that nobody told the Oireachtas, and that when the payroll for that month was processed, she was still paid as if she was the chair of that committee. In fact, Maria Bailey, it goes on to explain, offered to refund some of the portion for which she was overpaid. It's also not clear, according to that piece, whether Leo Varadkar knew at the time that he was demoting her as chair of the Housing Committee that she was also the chair of two other Oireachtas committees, and it's not clear whether the Taoiseach even knew about that at the time. A couple of other quick papers. The Irish Sunday Mirror, Owen Murphy, send the homeless out of Dublin. Housing Minister Owen Murphy plans to offer incentives to homeless people to move out of Dublin. His sweeping reforms include a package of supports for those in emergency shelter who are willing to relocate outside the capital. This will be discussed by the Cabinet next month. The Fine Gael politician said, there will be families, and I know this because I have met them. And I'm going on to another page, and I've put it on the wrong page, live radio. I know I've met some of them who would be open to relocating outside of Dublin, and that can be supported. Minister Murphy said his new strategy includes putting those who were twice refused social housing in their area of choice to the bottom of the list. And finally, for now, the Sunday World. Disgrace. Nicola Tallant has a story about two convicted killers who went on a crime rampage while they were on day release. Murderers nabbed after vicious attacks on homeowners. Victims groups blast parole board for releasing evil duo. So a bit of a whistle stop tour of all of the stuff that's on the front pages of the papers. But we'll start, predictably enough, with Brexit. Partly, Hugh O'Connell, I'll start with you in this. There's one story which is on the front page of the British Sunday Times, which is actually not in the Irish one at all, but it's about what Boris Johnson's latest backstop wheeze is. And it's actually buried quite a bit down. Talking about this idea of a sectoral approach to the backstop, where effectively the UK would sign up to the idea of honouring EU rules in the minimum number of areas needed to negate the need for a hard border in Ireland and still be free to digress in all the other ones. There's about 145 of those. So is that Brexit a name only? And B, would the Irish government actually accept it?
Well, that's cakeism, isn't it? That's this whole thing of having your cake and eating it, choosing to align yourself with EU rules that will not will ensure there's no hard border, but diverging elsewhere so you can strike third party or third country trade deals around the world and carry out the entire aim of Brexit, which was to kind of loosen up trade policy and be free to strike these mammoth deals.
Which was also something that Boris Johnson said explicitly in his letter to Donald Tusk during the week, where he explicitly said, we want to diverge. So it seems to be something of doublespeak. But I mean, do you think it would fly with Ireland?
Would it fly here?
Yeah.
No.
Why not?
Well, because...
Is it not a practical solution to avoid the necessity of a hard border?
It is a solution. Whether it is a practical and workable solution is another matter. And I think that Boris Johnson has, in the last week, outlined his strategy such as it is. We got more detail than we've ever had to date in the letter that he wrote to Donald Tusk, but also his frequent quoting of the Alternative Arrangements Commission, which are carrying out this report. It's chaired by a bunch of, co-chaired by two Tory MPs, I think one Leave and one Remainer. Greg Hands is one of them. I met him in Dublin in June or July, and he took me through some of the proposals, but it's a lot of the stuff that has already been dismissed out of hand, and we see in the Sunday Business Post today, already dismissed by the European Union.
What sort of ideas are they putting on the table?
The Irish government. Well, it's this idea of, I think, trusted trader schemes. You'd have mobile veterinary units that would travel around Northern Ireland checking on animals and stuff like that. These are interesting proposals, but I don't think they're going to fly. And so we are really at a situation where nothing's going to break the impasse at this stage unless one side is prepared to back down.
Well, I'll come back to on that. Tory Minister Greg Hands, it's mentioned in the Sunday Business Post this morning that he's hosting a conference at the Carrickdale Hotel in Dundalk, which is literally just right over the border. I think you, tentatively speaking, have to cross into County Armagh to get to the Carrickdale Hotel off the M1. He's hosting a conference on September the 13th and 14th where he's going to try and drum up support from that. I think that's exactly where Sinn Féin are holding their pre-Dáil thinking only a couple of days earlier, so I wonder if there'll be any overlap there. Jim McGrath, you were a government advisor at the time that all of this began to hit the fan. What do you make of the idea that German sources, now I don't know how good the German sources are speaking to the Sunday Times, but they say that Angela Merkel, to her surprise, found Boris Johnson's proposal to have this kind of sectoral approach to the backstop, that they found it credible, which would suggest that one of the most influential people in Europe actually thinks that this could be the solution we were looking for.
Yeah. I'm actually, this is the most interesting thing out of all the papers across UK and Ireland in Brexit, on Brexit today. Mm. Why I'm kind of slightly positive about this, or at least it's very interesting, is there are 142 or 145 areas of cooperation. By the time you put legally operational language beside all of these, you have a backstop. That is actually what it is. So it's interesting that by the time Boris Johnson engages in the details, what it is he briefs on those areas that are will align on these areas. That's exactly what the backstop is. By the time you take those 145 areas, you put the legal language beside them, you come up with effectively what a backstop is.
So you think he's reaching the same conclusion, but we just need to give him time to do it through his own logic.
Partly, yeah. Now, I think what is very keen for Boris Johnson is to retain the Brexiteers, that we have the ability to diverge in all of these areas. So that's the key about the detail of this. If he takes the approach of, well, there's 145 of them covered under cross-border cooperation and the all-island economy, and we put legal language beside them to make sure we have the right alignment, then you have a de facto backstop. Where he wants to do is the right to diverge in other areas.
There's not many other areas there, though. If you've already like signed up to what the EU is doing or what Ireland is doing in 145 areas, there's not much scope left.
That's exactly the point. And that's why I think, at least in this country, this is in a way validates the Brexit policy today, that as soon as Boris Johnson engages in the details of what is required on the Irish border, it becomes very clear that the backstop is the natural logic solution for what you try and do. Mm. And nothing will actually change that. Now, it flies in the face of everything the Brexiteers say about what they want from sovereignty. So this, to me, exposes the inherent intellectual dishonesty and contradiction in the entire Brexiteer debate, and it validates why, at least at this point in this country, we need to keep our cards close to our chest, not diverge, not engage in some of the distraction tactics that Boris Johnson is engaging by actually saying nothing. If you remember, Boris Johnson only a few weeks ago was saying things like, I won't even talk to you unless we actually get rid of the backstop. Mm. That's a precondition.
Yeah. And yet he's sitting down with Donald Tusk this morning.
Exactly. It's going to be very difficult for this, for all the businesses that are exposed for Brexit, but politically, by Leo Varadkar and everyone else and Simon Coveney not saying too much and not engaging this debate, our proportionate power in this sort of it's a kind of a phony war negotiation is actually increasing all the time. So in a negotiation terms, there's still a very long way to go on Brexit, and this unfolds in the coming weeks will actually be fascinating.
And it's 67 days, I think, to go until they're due to leave. Sheila, do you agree with that, or does anything else that stands out from you from what you've read this morning?
I don't necessarily agree with it, because I think the issue is you can't leave them in a position where they can, as Hugh said, have their cake and eat it. And that's the problem for the EU, in that if the UK are to decide what rules they don't like out of all the other ones, bar the 142 or whatever, well, then what's to stop the rest of us doing the same? Throwing our toys out of the pram in relation to this and the other. I think that's probably the biggest difficulty for them.
But the reality, idea, though, that if they were signing up to something which said that they would do, it's a kind of a good faith thing, and they said, right, we will do whatever we need to do to ensure that there's a border, but we have to have some kind of new liberty. We have to take our sovereignty back in some areas, because, like Jim says, if you flesh out these 145 areas, you get something like the backstop that's currently there.
Right.
But the present backstop is comprehensive and covers every single sector, which it negates the idea of Britain having any independence to do pretty much anything afterwards. Mm. So at least this would possibly be the best of both worlds, where we get no hard border and Britain gets some of the trading liberty that it didn't have before now.
Well, Britain already, I mean, they already have a degree of liberty. They just, you know, they're just kind of skirting around. They've just continuously blamed the EU for what they see as that they don't have any liberties at all, and they blame the EU for everything, thanks in part to the work of Boris Johnson as a journalist over the years as well, it must be said, you know. And here what we find with Johnson is you have a scenario where he has to be seen to come back with something. He has to have something to show to Parliament, or otherwise he's just going to go absolutely nowhere, and he needs this. And really, I think we're down to semantics when you're talking about it at this stage. You know, in reality, it probably, Jim is probably right to a degree in that it's a backstop in all but name. But I go back to my point about if they're seen to be able to choose what rules they don't want to, adhere to it, well, then that just, to my mind, gives more ammunition to all the anti-European parties out there as well, who are building up their own war chests and their own fraternities as time goes on to try and break down the EU even further.
Yeah, when you mention Boris Johnson's previous life with the Daily Telegraph as the Brussels correspondent, there's a great piece in John Byrne's Atticus column on the back page of the Sunday Times today. Former political journalist Senna Maloney has recalled bumping into a very lost Boris Johnson in 1990. Boris was supposed to be reporting on an EU summit being held in Dublin Castle for the Telegraph, except he was on Terenure Road East, which is more than 5 kilometres away. This is a quote from something that Senna Maloney has written. Seeking help, Johnson rolled down the passenger window and bawled at me, "Dublin Castle," Maloney recalls. Directions duly given, but no gratitude was exhibited, nor did his features evince any amused or ironic comprehension of the ludicrousness of his then position. John Byrne merely adds that it's a timely metaphor. Hugh, there's another piece in the Sunday Times, the British Sunday Times again, talking about the divorce bill and Boris Johnson apparently having ordered government lawyers to calculate how much of the £39 billion that the UK could legally get away with. They reckon that if there was to be no deal, that he could basically balk on the £39 billion and then walk away having only paid 7 or 8. One of the lines that's in there is that they will need, if there's no deal, Brussels will need to organise a whip round. This is attributed to a senior British government source. Yeah. If there's no deal, Brussels will need to organise a whip round because they'll need to plug a huge hole from our contribution and they'll need billions to keep Ireland afloat. Which to me illustrates, again, some degree of not really understanding how the EU works.
No, this is the usual kind of thing of, oh, well, you know, they're going to need to bail out Ireland and Ireland is going to be completely helpless if Britain crashes out on the 31st of October. Therefore, they're going to need to be propped up. But it's, you know, to me, it's just kind of repeating some of the kind of misplaced rhetoric that's been around in British political circles for the last 3 years on Ireland and the level of EU support on Ireland. And this idea that the EU would abandon Ireland and the very harsh, personalised criticism of Leo Varadkar.
Yeah. But also the idea that they would apparently intervene to prop up Ireland in the same way that they haven't had any interest in propping up to intervene to prop up the UK, which has been running massive deficits for the last 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
The idea
yeah.
that somehow now Ireland would be worthy of the Brussels shilling.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose that, you know, they feel that, you know, Ireland will be the most damaged by this. But I mean, I think Phil Hogan made the point during the week that the UK actually stood to be damaged the most from a hard Brexit.
Yeah.
And the British people will probably suffer the most. Nonetheless, we see a lot of this story in the Sunday Times today, Tim Shipman's story, is built around the idea that they're now wargaming an election before the European summit on the 17th, that the election will have taken place by the time of the European summit, the last European summit before Brexit, on the 17th and 18th of October.
So that Boris could go back with a new mandate and try to negotiate things 12 days out.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. I mean, one of the ideas, actually, because I was looking at that and that caught my eye this morning. British general elections now traditionally tend to happen on a Thursday. I think the suggestion was that they would war game to have the election on October the 17th, which would be the first of the 2 days of the summit. Mm-hmm. And then, presuming that Boris Johnson wins, hops on a Eurostar at 5 a.m. with a fresh mandate in his back pocket.
Yeah, but what if he doesn't? Like, what if it's a hung parliament? What if, like, Jeremy Corbyn is actually in a position to form a government? What happens then? I mean, I think this is, like, you know, okay, so there's a poll out today which shows that the Tories 12 points clear. But I mean, the Tories were well clear of Labour in advance of the 2017 general election, and we saw what happened
there.
Which
is precisely why it was called.
I mean, one thing that a general election would probably do in almost all scenarios would remove the DUP in terms of their influence and power within Westminster. I don't think that they would come back in the same sort of position where they would effectively hold the balance of power again. So that might open up the possibility to move on some of the issues that they've been perceived to have been blocking in and around, you know, putting up a border between the East-West divide and the worry that they have that Northern Ireland would be split off from the rest of the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson might be less worried about that if he doesn't have to rely on the DUP for
potentially
support.
So, although trying to turn that around after standing up so willfully at the DUP conference and harking all of that as if it was his own policy, it might be a slightly difficult thing to square. Lucinda Creighton is writing in the Sunday Business Post today that the clock is ticking on Brexit and her only option is to delay catastrophe. She says a political compromise could realistically entail a time limit of 5 years on the backstop, with Ireland and the EU committing to deliver a comprehensive EU-British trade deal in that time frame, which would negate the need for a permanent backstop. Such an outcome is not without risk. It does keep alive the possibility of Britain ultimately leaving without any guarantees for the border in the north, but the government would be prudent to postpone such a disastrous outcome for as long as possible. Jim McGrath, is she right?
Fundamentally, yes. If we get the chance to delay Brexit, we possibly should. And definitely delaying a no-deal Brexit will be much easier on our businesses.
But she says put a time limit on the backstop to do that.
Yeah, let me start by saying this. Boris Johnson has a very effective communication strategy for the British electorate. He doesn't have a diplomatic strategy or an economic strategy as of yet, or at least he hasn't put one forward. I think there is definitely, this isn't going to evolve without a time and a place. There has to be some type of a compromise on the backstop. Not because I necessarily believe we should, but because that is the political reality that has taken hold of the UK. Before some kind of a deal is done or some accommodation has come to, there will have to be some accommodation on the backstop. There is no doubt about that. But from Ireland's point of view, I wouldn't be offering it now. Okay. I would be waiting to see what the British actually come up with. Are the British giving us as some kind of an incentive? Are they even trying to meet our objectives? If you think about this in diplomatic terms, Boris's tactic, it's very good. It has given the Tory party a boost. It makes electoral sense in the UK, and he's definitely getting the Brexiteer support. Mm. Okay, so and that's what he wants to achieve. He's not behaving though as if he actually wants a deal. And is he coming up to the table with solutions that would actually meet the same objectives as the backstop? At least as yet, not that we can see. So again, it's just another example. It's the diplomatic equivalent of holding Ireland hostage, bullying Ireland. You know, it's the type of political rhetoric the Brexiteers need to engage in before they ever sign up to any deal, if there ever is to be a deal. I think at a point in time, if Boris Johnson and the UK government are coming saying, look, Ireland, we understand these are your concerns. This is how we will at least try to fix them. And if those are real and substantial things, then we shouldn't be. If they're willing to help us, we should be willing to help them. But so far, it's not so much that they're not even willing to help us. Their Brexit strategy would destroy Ireland's place in the single market and really destroy our economic model. So this is bullying tactics. They are coming for us in a very aggressive way. So we should be careful about incentivizing how we help them in that. But if that tide ever turns, we shouldn't be shy about trying to help Britain and Europe reach an accommodation together.
Sheila, meet them halfway.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a logic in relation to that. But even if you look at, say, the alternative arrangements report, and one of the things is that would be an all-island kind of food zone, safety food zone. If that came into place, then, I mean, straight away, were the UK to diverge in any way from EU rules, then we could be pulled out with them were that to happen.
So it seems that an awful lot of their policies basically involve Ireland having to swallow a certain amount of
non-European. That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, there seems to me to be like we're taking a hit no matter whichever way we turn, you know, and that there's an issue. It's a no-win scenario for us anyway, but it's a no-win scenario no matter what happens. I mean, to me, one of the biggest things about Brexit today in the front of the papers is the thing about the English and Scottish police ready for the border patrols. You know, I know when you dig down into that piece, basically it's just that there's plans drawn up to deploy officers from the Scottish forces first, I think 300 in particular, 300 from Scotland, I think, and that were more needed, they would take English police officers. There's obviously an acknowledgement there that would be politically sensitive, to say the least.
A source at London City Hall said all the police forces have agreed to give support to Northern Ireland. It is a concern. Thankfully, it wouldn't affect too many London officers, but we will be there. And then he adds, and this is the crucial line, imagine it, officers from the mainland in Northern Ireland, bloody hell. And I'm inclined to think that bloody hell is actually not so much an epithet as possibly a prediction of what might be going on.
Well, yeah, it definitely is the case. I think that would just be totally unacceptable to a lot of people living in the border areas, to say the least, and indeed to most places in Northern Ireland. I know there is a precedent. They were over there. It comes in under that mutual aid programme that they have. So there would have been police officers from the UK over during the G8 in Fermanagh. Yeah. That was a totally different ball game.
But not for the frontline policing.
Yeah,
absolutely not.
And that you potentially might have them trying to deal with, you know, terrorism in the north, or potential terrorism. Literally, they wouldn't have the skills. I mean, they wouldn't have the level of training that the PSNI have. So, potentially, not only to mind, and then add that on top of the tinderbox that it could create within the nationalist community. I think it's an absolutely disastrous notion, to be honest.
Yeah, one person has texted into 53106 with an idea that I have always been a fan of, harking from Jim's point there, that maybe Boris Johnson is coming up with a backstop of his own, that maybe it's just a branding issue. Maybe we should just call it by some cricket term
whatever
instead of a baseball.
He wants to call,
it the wicketkeeper next time. Although the way the Ashes is going, maybe that might be the best idea either. There's two stories on the front pages of some of the broadsheets, both on a health theme, which together paint a pretty dysfunctional idea. There's Wayne O'Connor on the front page of the Sunday Independent, who has called up hundreds of different GP surgeries and has found that basically half of them are full, half of them say their doors are open, but there are some who genuinely say they're not even sure if they could take on a new patient. And then there's the front page of the Sunday Times, which says that taking private healthcare out of public hospitals would cost the state around 6.6 billion euro and take twice as long as the launch of care strategy intended. Sheila, when you put the two together, it's not the greatest picture that it's portraying, is it?
No, it really, really isn't. I mean, I don't think who is surprised in this country to read that about the plan that it would take twice as long and twice as much.
It's almost an art for journalists to try and to present it in a way that isn't just health is bad.
I know, it really is unbelievable. I mean, as I say, I looked at it this morning and went, oh God almighty, this again. But the reality is, it's no surprise. It's going to cost 6.6 billion according to the Dick Butler report, which is twice as long as recommended in the Sláinte Care strategy, and it could take up to 10 years, which just again seems absolutely preposterous to say the least.
Of the three of you, sorry to interrupt you, Sheila, can any of the three of you, because I'm genuinely perplexed about this, what are the costs of removing private healthcare from a public hospital? What is the cost that you incur?
Well, apparently you have their staffing, obviously, because you have to replace the staffing if you lose consultants and things like that.
Okay.
There's equipment or equipping, so I don't know how the equipment comes into it, but it says here equipping. And there's also issues in relation to the loss of earnings from the private health insurance companies that you would be.
So you have to compensate them for the income.
Well, you have to plug the gap. You're plugging the gap, if you like, for what you're losing there. And also then as well, imagine the skills you could be losing as well, because needless to say, you know, private healthcare are the best people going to go then to work in the private sector and all that. And then are you going to have to be paying top dollar? You're going to have to match those salaries. And here we start again with we're back on to consultants' fees, consultants' salaries and all this sort of, we go down this rabbit hole once again, you know. It just seems to me to be, here we are back again, another rabbit hole in relation to this ongoing quest to diverge private and public healthcare.
That was a really heavy sigh that you might have heard from Hugh O'Connell in the middle of all of that.
He
kind of put his hands to his face and just kind of deeply lamented the general state of the country. Hugh, have
well, no, but I mean, it's like Sláinte Care, like there's no political will for Sláinte Care. The Taoiseach hasn't spoken particularly praiseworthy of it when he has ever spoken about it. I think he's often pointed out the cost that would be involved as being prohibitive towards it being implemented. And I think that, you know, the government and Simon Harris in the Department of Health has been very slow to get moving on this idea. This is a cross-party report that was delivered, I think, 2 years ago now at this stage, maybe 3 years ago, but certainly a long time ago. And there doesn't seem to be an enormous amount of political will to get it implemented. And certainly from talking to people in Fianna Fáil privately about this in the past, they have also indicated that they're not particularly mad into it either.
But then what is their replacement strategy? Because the whole point of Sláinte Care is that everyone had different ways of pulling in different directions. And at least everyone said, OK, let's all get together. Let's have a mutual health strategy. And then basically every party adopts that as the foundation
for
it.
But this was the whole idea, right? Let's get cross-party political ownership of health. So no matter what party is in government, this is the strategy that we've been
implementing. You're suggesting that the major two parties no longer have any truck with it.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Yeah, well, they don't. But I don't think they
so
do.
What's their policy?
It was described to me by someone in Fianna Fáil as like Sláinte Care 2.0. It'll be a policy they'll roll out, I presume, in advance of the general election, but we haven't seen it. And look, I mean, Jim is well used to this from his days in government, slagging off Fianna Fáil. But they have been often criticised over the last 7 or 8 years for not having a health policy, Fianna Fáil. Mm. And I think that we are still to see one, being honest.
Jim, there's hardly much value in Sláinte Care 2.0 if Sláinte Care 1.0 isn't getting much value either.
I suppose, to put it this way, we have a political consensus around what's needed to be done with the health service, but there is clearly a big financial black hole. This also was entirely predictable 2 years ago when Sláinte Care was proposed. It was the biggest. It was the biggest kind of trailing leg. Now, you know, fundamentally puts two questions to it. Does the Department of Health get additional funding if you were to really rip all the private healthcare out of the public system?
Yeah.
And that will be strongly resisted by the Department of Public Expenditure. So where does that actually leave us? It leaves us in another place where the political system wants one thing, but the financial operations of it are not going to be easy and smooth. And that actually is the story of the Irish Health Service.
Yeah, well, it tells you a lot about Irish politics in general, this idea that you can build all these lofty master plans and do it, but then when it comes to actually having to charge somebody a tax to pay for it, that everyone just goes, ah, we can't be doing that. But yeah. Like, there's an awful disconnect between policies being drawn up and then actually anyone ever pulling up their trousers and actually just doing the bloody thing.
Yeah, it no, you have to remember, Sláintecare, I suppose, was, two things. It was a product of an Oireachtas Health Committee. So all the political parties get together. And in fairness, it was delivered in quite a cohesive manner, and everyone did work together and there was compromises. And there is a portion of the Irish political parties that would, how would I put it? They were very sceptical of having private healthcare interests involved in our public system and would probably prefer an ideal separation. But given that so much of the public system is actually reliant on private healthcare, unpicking that is going to be as tricky as our previous topic of Brexit.
When do we blink?
Yeah. I think what ultimately kind of two things need to happen. I mean, that you can actually do that, but as the Butler points out, it will take about 10 years. Now, the political expectations, you know, we'll all go into the next election or whenever it is and expect health service results to be delivered more immediately. From my own view, I think where we go from here is, what is the appropriate place for private healthcare to be operational within our public health system?
And if we
at least try to answer that question, then we might get to a more realistic political consensus on that in time. But having just a typical kind of debate around, we have to, private healthcare is endemic to the public health system in Ireland. That might be wrong, it might be immoral, but unpicking that is hugely operationally complex, and to try and do that without undermining patient care is going to be very difficult in Ireland.
The Sunday Times notes that Simon Harris is due to publish that de Butler report this week, but it's not clear whether it will be discussed at Cabinet or whether it will go straight to the Dáil. The recommendations have not yet been discussed by Cabinet, but the Taoiseach told the Dáil in June that he had read it, so at least this has been knocking around for 2 or 3 months. Micheál Martin, the Fianna Fáil leader at the time, demanded its publication and said the decision to incorporate private consultants at the new National Children's Hospital showed that it was to a large extent dead and buried before it starts. All of which suggests, I suppose, that the consensus which led to Sláintecare being held up as some sort of landmark act of cross-partisan cooperation is maybe dead in the water. Hugh, I want to come back to your own native stable for the other story by Wayne O'Connor, who has done, in fairness to him, an awful lot of work, calling up about 330 different GPs across the country to try and figure out whether any of them are taking on new patients or not. Notably, he called up a few different GP surgeries in Laois, for example, and was told that 100% of them are not taking on new patients. That's not necessarily just urban Ireland, where the population has grown massively and the GPs haven't necessarily caught up. That this is a cross-country phenomenon where there are GPs everywhere who simply just don't have the capacity to take on new people.
And the other interesting thing I thought he found as well is that even those who are registered with a GP, in a GP practice, can't get to see their normal GP and have to go to someone who is unfamiliar with them and they are unfamiliar with them, the patient is. And I think, you know, that it can be quite problematic for certain patients. So I think it shows the extent to which GP practices are under enormous pressure at the moment, and we probably need more GPs in this country.
Sheila, I think it's probably the real thing that it highlights is that it's not just an urban thing, that, for example, 40% of GPs in Connacht, 30%, 37% in Ulster, 58% across all of Leinster. In fact, it's only 45% in Dublin. People would think that it's
more,
predominantly
an
urban thing, but in areas like your own, in Cavan or in Longford, that there's GPs that are overwhelmed there too.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I would know that anecdotally, locally, it's quite hard to get a new GP in those areas.
80% of GPs in Longford are full up, and in Cavan there's 40% who are full and 40% who can take on more, and 20% who aren't sure.
And in Leitrim was the only county, I think, in the whole country that where there was some availability. So if you all want to trot down to Leitrim there to get your GP. But I think looking at the map, if you like, that they have in the Independent there today, that cross-country element of it is really kind of highlighted. You can see the whole swath that comes down from Louth the whole way down to Limerick. Literally, it's like a stripe through the middle of the country, you know. And that just goes to show kind of that it's not just an issue about commuter belt, but it is an issue about kind of bad planning and lack of vision, if you like. And there's a lot of talk, and you know, you go back to kind of one thing, politicians say one thing and then do another. A lot of talk about primary healthcare and about putting money into that, the primary healthcare structure, but the reality is that hasn't been playing through on the ground. And this piece explains as well, that's about 700 GPs due to retire in the next 7 years. So that's going to even put greater pressure on the whole structure. I mean, it just seems absolutely crazy. Ireland has, according to the piece there, 68 GPs per 100,000. They're comparing that to Canada, which is 110, and Australia, which is 120. So that kind of puts it in perspective as to where we are in the reality of how far behind and how difficult it is in some places to get a GP. And then another thing it touches on, which you mentioned, is the reliability, the reliance then on what they call the co-ops, or like My Doc or Shannon Doc, or some of those places where you end up going to those out of hour services because you can't access your own GP. And that's fine for a one-off, but if you've got a chronic illness, if it's an ongoing illness you have, that you're not actually being, I don't mean properly looked after, but it's not
part of your long-term ongoing care you're supposed to.
And then you see there's the pressure then being put on the GPs from the under sixes being free. And I think there's been an increase there, a great increase in the number of patients going into GPs since under six care was made free. And now, of course, we know that the under 12s are next in line for that, up to under 12s in the next couple of years. So that's going to put further pressure on this whole system. So what you have is a lot of talk about putting investment into primary care, that this is where we want to put the focus on, this is the logic, but then the reality is it's just not coming through on the ground.
So if we have a situation where we're running out of GPs, where there's already so many practices that can't afford to take anyone on, if we're going to have a spate of retirements in the coming years and the circumstances are not attractive enough to keep people there, and we already have a slouch care plan which appears now to be out of whack 2 years on because it's based on timetables and budgets that can't be delivered, are we at the point where we just abandon slouchy care? Do we just go back to forget the consensus and have a general election in 6 or 12 months where everyone's running on their own different health policies anyway? Because it'll be a weird general election if everyone's batting on the same health policy anyway, given how dumb they usually are.
I think each party will have a different...
Well, they have their own slant on slouchy care.
That's exactly it.
I think some of these problems will take a lot more than one electoral cycle to solve. Mm. Now, I will say this, and it is a terrific story by Sunday Independent and Wayne O'Connor. A lot of aspects of our health service do actually work very well. They don't get the public attention, but one area that the Irish Health Service is chronically understaffed. It takes about 9 years to train a GP. Mm. So no political party is going to fix this between the next election and the election after that.
And so isn't that the problem with healthcare in this country, in the way that we look at it, in that because we are so tied to those electoral cycles, if you like, and politicians think in terms of electoral cycles, that's the reality of it. And that's why health has been so difficult. And that was the whole point of slouchy care. That's why it's kind of devastating the way to hear you say this about the two parties. I'm just going to lost interest in this.
This is one we're talking about. Slouchy care is much bigger than just the things we're talking about today. So there's a lot of things that are positive about slouchy care and will actually last kind of 10 years or longer. So by no means should we be throwing it out, especially if nothing else, if there's one thing that can unite the political system around the health service, let's not throw it out easily. But let's also say there are major operational challenges that will really test that political consensus on slouchy care, and who or what has the capacity to solve it. That's where I'm not sure.
Hugh, we're going to talk about Garda reform, but just before that, we mentioned in passing earlier on some of the work that the Sunday Times had done. They seem to have a pretty big tranche of FAI board minutes and documents and the likes, and there's a particular piece on page 4 about John Delaney's attitude to the media that you wanted to mention.
Well, I just found this a very interesting story. Now, I suppose I would. It's kind of an inside the Beltway story in the sense that it's how an organisation deals with journalists. Mm. But the approach is interesting in that Delaney took a case against the journal.ie in relation to some of its coverage of him in relation to its coverage of the Rio Olympics and the Pat Hickey story.
Because he was the vice president of the Olympic Council at the time. Yeah.
And he was somewhat tied to that. And what Delaney is, according to his board minutes, admitted that he took a case against the journal, admitted it was not a strong case, but he was keeping it alive so they don't write anything about us. So basically implying that if I sue these guys, they will stop writing about me. This creates this kind of chilling effect, whereas in fact the journal continued to write about John Delaney in the same way everyone else has continued to write about John Delaney over the last few years.
Which is a point that's mentioned, that the Adriana Costa, who's the CEO of Journal Media, says that it doesn't allow litigation affect how they cover matters of public interest.
It's not just the journal, it's joe.ie. It records him having met with Niall McGarry and saying that they should go away and reflect on their coverage of the FAI. I'm not sure what Joe.ie did in response to that. Really intriguing tidbit about Delaney briefing the board on having a strong case against the Irish Examiner and claiming that one of the journalists involved told Patrick O'Donovan, the junior minister for sport, that he, quote, feared for his job. Mm. Now, it goes on to say the sources of the Examiner and a source close to the minister insist no such conversation occurred and no journalist's jobs was ever at risk over Denny's complaint. But I think this kind of aggressive approach towards journalists and this sort of almost bullying approach towards journalists is a really bad thing that shouldn't be happening. And I, you know, I hope that with the new regime coming into the FAI, that that's something that's going to change. Because, I mean, again, the story notes the Sunday Times football correspondent Paul Roan was basically ostracised and not allowed to ask questions at press conferences because he probably took a line that was somewhat diverging from that, you know, saying the FAI is great and isn't Delaney doing a great job and isn't everything hunky-dory.
Yeah.
And it's particularly problematic, I think, in sports journalism, where journalists who try to ask questions, hard questions of people, get shut down.
Yeah.
I think it shouldn't happen.
There is definitely an attitude, I think, within some aspects of sports journalism that people think that the people who are covering them ought to be effectively some kind of a PR rather than holding them up to any kind of a scrutiny.
There was a very revealing dispute discussion after Manchester City won the FA Cup last season where Pep Guardiola was asked about various issues in relation to Manchester City that have been highlighted over the years and the amount of money that's been poured into the club. And he got very snippy with this journalist and basically shut him down and wouldn't answer the question, wouldn't deal with what I thought was a legitimate question. I think it was around his salary arrangements because there had been some interesting salary
arrangements. And it was the first time that any club had ever completed a domestic treble, and maybe it was perhaps insensitive timing because of the scale of the achievement, but nonetheless they had just walloped, was it Watford 6-0 in the final?
Yeah.
So you can understand why you might be talking about the haves and the have-nots. We'll park that for the time being. I want to go back to the story that we said we were going to discuss, which is Garda reform. There's not so much in today's papers, but then yesterday's Irish Examiner led with a pretty apt headline about it all. Garda divisions merger, quote, a total disaster. Effectively, Sheila, the substance of this, or correct me if I'm wrong, is that they announced that they were going to rationalise all the Garda divisions and cut down on the levels of senior management, but nobody told the senior managers that there would be fewer of them.
Yes, and that there's particularly the superintendents and the SAR are particularly aggrieved at this, as you can imagine, because they are the ones, I think, that would be most impacted by the reduction in units. So that was kind of that seemed to be where the biggest bite back is coming back for the commissioner from this. I mean, I'm sure it's entirely expected, to be fair. You know, I don't know how they couldn't have predicted that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what they're proposing to do is create kind of divisions where you'll have this assembly, like a chief superintendent who's going to be a sort of a de facto commissioner for that region, and there'll be four supers underneath him. Interestingly, I was interested in the division of the workload of those. Two are going to be dealing with the public, one with crime investigation and one with performance, you know. So I would have thought it should have been two for crime investigation, you would imagine. But hopefully if they do have two people who are dealing, or two supers dealing with the public, they'll also be dealing with press and local media because we're finding them increasingly difficult to deal with it. Local Gardaí don't want to talk to, or find it more and more difficult to talk to local media, and increasingly are kind of pushing us back, sending us back towards the press office.
What's behind that?
I don't know. And it seems to be totally and utterly arbitrary. It could happen in some areas and not in others, you know. So you'd have some places where you'd have difficulty. And this is all kind of anecdotal in that, you know, I'm travelling around the country for my work, so I'm coming across people from all different groups on all different media outlets, and they would all say something similar. So it just seems to depend on the area that you're in. But it's this is not that I'm just, you know, battling my own drum here, but there's obviously a wider issue here in relation to how is this whole plan going to play out? And like, I know what you're going to see is a rural political kind of turf war, because everybody's going to want to have the divisional headquarters in their own constituency. And I mean, that's just preposterous, because I don't really think people care where the superintendent is based on any given day. They just want to see more guards in their area. They just want to see more guards in Ballybor or in Ballymahon or wherever else it might be, or in their communities. And that's what this will live and die on if it gets passed anywhere.
The Association of Garda Superintendents. The one thing that confuses me about all of this, Jim, is that if the idea was to free up more Gardaí or more members of the force to go on frontline policing duties or to be out on the beat, that's all well and good. But that if you're going from having 18 different divisions into 9, but you still have the same number of cheap supers or supers, you're hardly expecting people who were previously involved at senior levels of management to ultimately start going back out on the beat. So all of these people are still going to want to have some sort of senior organisational role, and it doesn't necessarily free up as many people further down the food chain. It's not as if this is a complete abolition of previous management roles.
Yeah, I think part of that answer to that is probably increased civilianization. I think in that we get more civilians into the service, it should in theory free up resources, albeit at least at first glance, you know, the idea that there are potentially 1,600 Gardaí kind of behind desks at the minute that could immediately come forward into frontline service sounds a little too good to be true on the face of it. And it would be very interesting to see what the breakdown of that 1,600 is, how many of them are actually new recruits that will come in future years, or what exactly the system is behind that. I suppose one of the most significant things about this is why at least the first step wasn't to consult with the superintendent.
I was going to say that. You surely at least get your ducks in a row and don't announce something on day one and then the day two story being how come you didn't ask anyone about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting tactic. So it's either, you know, one, they went with the first initial communication of it, which I would say kind of landed well, and most people would read it and go, that as a Garda reform, that would make some sense to me. Did they chose we'll go with the plan up front and we'll tweak the plan as we need to consult, or why they didn't go consult up front. And I'd be very interested into the reason behind that. It might be, did they price in this negative reaction from the Garda superintendents? Were they waiting to see what the public mood of us was when it landed? So it seems to me like it's a first step, and there's probably a long way to go in terms of this Garda reform.
Well, speaking of the long way to go, Hugh, you're also taken very quickly by a story at the top of page 6 of the Sunday Times about some investigations that the Disclosure Tribunal is currently undertaking, and it involves some of the organisations that were set up to have a look at the police in the first place.
It's a story by John Mooney. It just says that the tribunal is examining the actions of the policing authority chair, Josephine Feely, as part of its inquiry into allegations that Garda whistleblowers were targeted for raising concerns about wrongdoing in the force. Now, there's no suggestion of wrongdoing on Ms. Feely's part, but you know, that's obviously going to play out when the Disclosures Tribunal resumes oral hearings in October. But I suppose we forget, having reported on the Maurice McCabe saga,
that the tribunal still
remains
ongoing.
There are other whistleblowers. Nicky Keogh is named in this story. He's a member of the drug squad in Meath who raised concerns about Garda involvement in drugs trade in the Midlands. And interestingly, of course, this comes in the context of the policing authority being abolished by the government, or the intention to abolish by the government, because that's something that was recommended by the Future Policing in Ireland Commission, which didn't necessarily target the policing authorities as having a need to be shut, or it being needed to be shut down, but rather there should be new oversight bodies set up that would in effect negate what the authority does, which is interesting because the authority was set up amid much fanfare 3 or 4 years ago. And is now,
which again has sorts of echoes of the Sláintecare idea when we had this massive reform in 2014-15, and this was supposed to be the panacea that was going to fix all the ills, and then you have another review 3 years later that says get rid of it. It does seem a little bit like Sláintecare, where you have this massive idea where you say we're going to knock down the walls once and for all, and then 2 or 3 years later you go, well, we'll knock down all those walls, but can we rebuild that one and that one and that one?
And I mean, the policing authority has been very clear that it doesn't want to be abolished, and you know, Ms. Feely's fighting a rearguard action in that respect, so maybe it will remain in place in some shape or form. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds over the next years, but obviously, you know, albeit that there are not the scale of Garda controversies and scandals and kind of political fallout from that as there was, you know, in recent times. And there was a very glowing tribute to Charlie Flanagan in one of the papers this week. But it does show that the Garda reform is ongoing, and it's something that's going to have to be tackled by many governments to come, I suspect.
Garda reform is ongoing, health reform is ongoing, and it seems that Brexit is ongoing as well, because in the last couple of minutes I've got two different push alerts. One from Sky News, which says that Boris Johnson has told Sky News that the chances of a Brexit deal are now improving. Boris Johnson, however, has told the BBC that having once said it was 1,000,000 to 1 that Britain would leave the EU with no deal, that it's now touch and go. Which suggests that as well as Garda reform and health reform, we could be talking about Brexit for a little while longer as well. I'm going to have to leave it there. Hugh O'Connell, Jim McGrath, and Sheila Riley, thank you all very much for joining me this morning and On the Record.